Pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So my name's Abigail. I'm very excited to be here today. So Taylor Patty, who is actually the one invited, is unable to be with us in person. So today I'm going to be talking about some work that I did while I interned at NVIDIA last fall under the guidance of Taylor Patty, Anima Anandkumar, as well as my advisor at Harvard, Susanna Yellen. And the title of this work is Near-Term Distributed Quantum Computation Using Optimal Auxiliary Encoding. Okay. So to start off, I'm going to discuss some of the various ingredients we have to our scheme, starting with a very high-level, abstract introduction to what I mean by distributed quantum computing. Then I'll spend some time talking about the two applications we focused on, namely fragmented time evolution and then fragment initialized VQE, which is really the point in the talk where machine learning comes into play. Okay, so let's dive in. So distributed quantum computing has been proposed as a way to address the scalability concerns of near-term hardware. For our purposes today, we don't need to become experts on the field. I certainly am not an expert. But I would like to give you a very basic overview of how we can imagine what distributed quantum computing will look like. So this little schematic is just nodes connected into some sort of graph or a network. Each of these nodes is meant to represent a quantum simulator or a quantum computer. Let's say that, for example, we have Alice who lives at this node and has some kind of quantum device at her disposal. And then maybe at another node, we have Bob with another quantum device. And in theory, these devices can be physically separated from each other. So these nodes are independent, but they are in communication with each other, and that's why they form a network. And in particular, this communication needs to be quantum in nature if we want to realize a true distributed quantum computer. So the main idea of distributed quantum computing is to have these separate quantum simulators cooperate with each other so that together they can pool their allocated resources and address a single quantum problem that is larger, more complicated than anything that Alice or Bob could hope to solve on their own. So there's a catch. In order for this to work, to have that quantum communication between nodes, we're going to need access to non-local operations. So you might imagine that in order to perform some protocol, maybe a qubit on Alice's device has to interact with one of Bob's qubits. So there are lots of schemes out there to accomplish something like this. One might physically shuttle the qubit or use some kind of quantum teleportation protocol, which would require that Alice and Bob share entanglement. The details of this I'm not going to be talking about, but the important thing to take away is that non-local operations are required, and in the near term, they're very costly. They're one of the main obstacles we have preventing us from realizing a true distributed quantum computer. So this leads to our motivating question: to what extent is distributed quantum computing viable when limited information transfer is passed between simulators? Okay, so we've been talking very abstractly. We're gonna keep it pretty abstract, but just to get a little more concrete, consider a system of, say, n qubits. So physically, we're going to partition this system into subgroups, and each of these subgroups is going to live on a different simulator. So we're interested in getting this whole group of qubits to act cooperatively, while the subgroups are only linked approximately via communication channels. So specifically, the task we're going to focus on for the first half of the talk is quantum time evolution. So we can talk about using a classical link between simulators, where we only employ classical information transfer between the simulators. And then we can also talk about using a quantum link where we do have access to some of those non-local operations, so we can employ some quantum information transfer, but I am going to assume that we don't have access to an unlimited number. We treat it as a limited resource. Okay. Great. So Now I can talk a little bit more in detail. Let's talk about a system now just split into two subsystems, which I will refer to as fragments. So within a given fragment, say this green fragment, we can include any and all interactions that exist between two qubits on the same fragment, right? There's no issues with that. But any interactions that cross the boundary of the two fragments or the interface, that's where we run into issues. That's where the non-local operations are required, so we aren't going to be able to include them in full. But we have a couple avenues that we'll use to kind of approximately mimic these missing interactions. So first, we're going to use mean field corrections that are informed by measurements. And secondly, we're going to use some extra qubits or auxiliary qubits that will help us facilitate some of those missing interactions. So today, I'm going to focus on Ising-like spin model Hamiltonians. They have this general form. There's my pointer. Generally, they have non-uniform coupling JIJ. But if all the JIJs are the same, then this model becomes the quantum Ising model. And then if, on the other hand, we set H equals to zero, then this Hamiltonian will map to those max cut problem graphs. Okay. So that's the general Hamiltonian, but we can also write down the Hamiltonian that acts within one subsystem, one fragment, say fragment A. So it will include all of the interactions that occur in fragment A, as well as some corrective term that's going to depend on the state of fragment B. Okay, so what do I mean by mean field corrections? You guys have already seen this Ising-like Hamiltonian that I just saw on the last slide. We can also write down the mean field approximation of a Hamiltonian like this. So if you're not familiar, mean field is often called a first order or even a classical approximation because it removes the interactions and replaces them with fields that depend on the mean excitation or mean magnetization of what would have been the interacting qubit. So that's what's right here. So basically, we are going to include the missing interactions as mean fields, operators just along Z that are weighted by the mean excitation of what would be the interacting qubits in the other fragments. Okay. And please interrupt me with questions if you guys have any. So yes, it generally is. If you want to be up to date with the current values, then it will be time dependent. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the other important ingredient that I mentioned was auxiliary qubits. The exact role of these qubits is going to depend heavily on the nature of our communication channels, but generally their purpose is to mediate the most important additional interactions that cross the interface of the fragments. This then enables the system qubits to become entangled with something other than each other so that they can behave as a mixed state if needed. Yes, right there. Okay, so here's how this might look for just something simple, nearest neighbor interactions, right? There's only one interaction that bridges this interface that we have to worry about. So we can just include one auxiliary qubit that kind of interacts with the qubits according to that missing interaction. So that was a pretty simple example, but there's another important detail. When we select an auxiliary qubit, how do we make sure it mediates the most important interactions? What are the most important interactions? And is there a way to do this optimally? So this choice was obviously really trivial for the case of nearest neighbor, but generally it's not going to be so straightforward. So there's a little rule we came up with. Basically, we want to select the auxiliary qubits so that the short time error simulation error due to fragmentation is going to be minimized. So using Taylor expansion, you can derive what this error is going to look like. So this is just one minus basically the fidelity of the system evolved under a fragmented Hamiltonian versus the exact system evolved under the full Hamiltonian. So a lot of math later, you can show that the first non-vanishing order just is the variance of the difference between these Hamiltonians. So that's the basic principle. We just want to select the environment qubit that contributes the most to this variance so that we reduce the error maximally. It turns out this is kind of interpretable, right? The difference between the Hamiltonians is going to be exactly equal to those missing interactions. So just as a little example, let's say we're interested in this green fragment, then any interactions that cross this, cross this red boundary are the ones that contribute to the variance. So that's kind of what we look at when we select the auxiliary. Okay, so now we kind of have the basics and we can move on to a real application, fragmented time evolution. But before we go too far, I want to just clarify how the role of auxiliary qubits is going to differ if we have a classical communication channel versus a quantum communication channel. So in the case of classical communication, we can use our minimum error rule to select the auxiliary encoding, say, after one time step or at the very beginning. But the important thing for classical is that the auxiliary qubits are going to be fixed throughout your time simulation. You select them at the beginning and they're just stuck there. So in this case, the auxiliary qubits are just kind of extra qubits that you keep with your fragment qubits, which imperfectly mimic a few environment qubits, sort of acting like as a buffer, if you will. But on the other hand, when quantum information transfer is possible, then we can make use of those limited non-local operations to selectively shuttle or teleport a handful of qubits between fragments. So the other important thing that I want to point out is that for the quantum case, we aren't required to use the same qubit, to shuttle the same qubit back and forth between fragments. Generally, we could update that choice kind of as our error changes, as our variance measurements might change. There we go, yeah. So in this case, the information is going to be physically shared between fragments, and it's not just local to one of them. Okay. Classical case for a minute. I just want to draw a quick schematic so that we can put everything together, get all our terminology straight. So just imagine 6 qubits for a minute. Let's say we split it up into 2 groups of 3. Really simple. Obviously very small. In general, all of these are going to interact with each other. So there's lots of interactions, and there's lots of these interactions. Is someone talking?
Probably online.
Okay. Lots of these interactions comprising this so-called interaction interface between the two fragments. So we can approximately include some of these interactions with auxiliary qubits, right? So these auxiliary qubits are going to target specific qubits in the opposite fragment that they kind of play the role of. And then we can also include some mean field corrections. I'm just drawing a handful of arrows here, but generally there's going to be a mean field correction for each missing interaction. So at the end of the day, for a classical link, we have 2 separate simulators evolving these 2 groups of qubits and periodically exchanging information about their mean field measurements. So that's where that time dependence comes in. Okay. How does it perform? So to start off, am I making those noises or? Okay, I don't know. to start off, let's consider a nearest neighbor quantum Ising model. Let's just say we have a chain of n qubits, which we can fragment into subgroups. I'm gonna use the label NF for the number of qubits per fragment, and then the label NA for that overlap, that's the number of auxiliary qubits that we are including. And this is for the classical case. I don't know if I mentioned that. Okay, so here are some results. I'll break it down. Here we're considering 12 qubits split into 2 groups of 6 with various numbers of auxiliary qubits. That's what these guys detail. And specifically here on the y-axis, we are looking at what we call the fragment fidelity. So that's the fidelity between the qubits simulated by the fragment with the exactly simulated full system. And we're averaging over the transverse field H, just so that we look at a variety of quantum Ising models. So here, let's see, In red, we have the case of no auxiliary qubits. So basically, this is no communication, the solid red. And then we are progressively adding one and then two. And then the dashed lines correspond to the inclusion of those mean field corrections. So first off, this shows that on average, including the mean field corrections does, in fact, improve the simulation performance. And moreover, as you might expect, as we include more and more auxiliary qubits, the performance gets closer and closer to exact. Okay, so we can also look at local observables. So this is the single qubit expectation along the transverse field direction. And I'm also fragmenting the system a little bit differently. So I'm actually splitting the 12-qubit system up into four subgroups of three, so really chopping it up now. And you can see, I've got the exact values plotted in black. You can see that with two auxiliary qubits, we get very close to the correct local expectation values for relatively long simulation times, in contrast to when there's no communication between the fragments. Okay. Okay, so now I'm going to move on to talk a little bit about what happens when we include quantum information transfer. So again, we're keeping this abstract, but just imagine that you have physically separated quantum simulators, and crucially, we now have access to at least a limited number of non-local operations. So now, let's say we want to include the operations between qubit 5 and the green fragment, then we can choose to send qubit 5 over to the green fragment to participate in those interactions before we send it back home. So, and again, the crucial point is that we don't always have to choose to send qubit 5 every time step. We might update our selection as the error changes. So this is kind of one step closer to how we imagine a true distributed quantum computer. But again, we're going to purposely limit the amount of the non-local interactions we include. Treating it as a limited resource, basically. Okay, so now we can't keep looking at the nearest neighbor model, right? Because when we incorporate quantum information transfer, the scheme would quickly become exact if we just had one auxiliary qubit, because there's only one interaction bridging the interface. So we're going to step things up a notch and consider instead generally an all-to-all Ising-like model, where we randomly, probabilistically select the Jij values to be plus one, minus one, or zero. So it's not exactly all-to-all, but generally all-to-all. Okay, so here's a comparison between the quantum, the classical, and then no communication. So again, we're looking at the fragment fidelity here, but this time we're averaging over 100 of those randomly generated Hamiltonians. From left to right, we're actually increasing the number of qubits in the system, but we're keeping the number of qubits per fragment fixed, so we're increasing the number of fragments that we're simulating at the same time. So again, like, I've abstracted all the complications about the nature of the communication, like how we're doing the quantum communication, how we're doing the trotterization. It basically amounts to selectively dropping some of the interactions and switching which ones we drop based on our optimal auxiliary rule. Okay. So again, this dark green line, this is our classical case, so that's kind of what we were looking at before. And you can see that it kind of struggles here, like the fidelities aren't as great, and that's really just because of the long-range, complicated nature of the models that I'm looking at now. But when we do have access to even limited quantum information transfer, we can get the state of the fragment much closer to correct, even at very long simulation times, which is really due to the fact that we are updating our choice of which auxiliary qubit we're sending. Okay. Mm-hmm. Go ahead. Yeah, that's a really good question. The question is how we can understand why the fidelity goes back up here. That's a good question. I'm not gonna lie, I don't understand it fully. My intuition is that maybe at this point, like all of the other environment qubits have been sent at that point, so the fragment qubits have kind of seen the entire environment at that point, and maybe that's why, but I'm not sure why it grows rather than just like plateauing. It's a good question. Okay. So the last thing I want to discuss related to time evolution is the role of optimal auxiliary encoding. Like, how much does it actually matter that we're sending the best choice? So to answer this, we're going to again look at an all-to-all Ising-like model, just so that the correct choice is a little more ambiguous. And I'm going to consider this exact case where we have 6 qubits split into 2 groups of 3. So that means we just have 3 choices for our auxiliary qubit. Okay, so we can rank the different choices based on their contribution to the variance. Recall that was what we derived the first non-vanishing error contribution to be. So let's see, here are the results. Okay, so again, this is the average fidelity. I think I'm averaging over 1,000 models now. And we're plotting all the different choices on average. So in green, we have V0, which corresponds to the maximum contribution. So that's the selection we make according to our optimal error minimization rule. And then in brown, we have the worst ranked choice that contributes the least to the variance. So you can see that it does kind of correspond to the best and worst cases out of the 3. So that kind of indicates that it is a pretty good way of like separating the choices. And the other kind of nice thing is that even for the classical case, it does translate to better performance at later times, even though it is a short time error metric. And then the distance actually is even larger for the quantum case. So now I want to move on to the second application, which might be more familiar to you guys, involving VQE. So I'm sure it needs no introduction, but just in case, the variational quantum eigensolver, or VQE, is a hybrid algorithm that's designed to find the ground state of a Hamiltonian. So VQE generally involves some kind of circuit ansatz with gates that are parameterized by rotation angles theta. After going through the circuit, we'll make measurements, and then we can put those measurements together to estimate the gradients of the loss with respect to the parameters. So in particular, for our loss, we're interested in the expectation value of some problem Hamiltonian. So we want this loss to be minimized such that the energy approaches the true ground state, right? And then once we have those gradients, we can feed them into some kind of classical optimization algorithm to get a new set of parameters, hopefully getting us one step closer to the true ground state. That kind of closes the loop. Okay, so what does VQE have to do with this project? Until now, I've kind of been talking about our approximate scheme as a stepping stone on the path towards distributed quantum computing. But here we're going to stray from that path a little bit, just to illustrate how our framework for approximately linked distributed computing can be extended to provide an excellent warm start to the optimization of a parameterized quantum circuit. So in this tangential application, the fragmentation just gives us a way to approximately simulate a full large quantum circuit with classical resources, which provides a way for us to pre-train the circuit parameters before we even need to touch quantum hardware. Okay. So again, this time we're fragmenting the circuit, which just amounts to literally slicing through the gates, producing smaller circuits. Importantly, we're going to have some overlapping registers that appear in more than one circuit, and that's kind of analogous to the auxiliary qubits that we've already discussed at length. And then we can further approximately link the optimization of the separate circuits by minimizing our fragment Hamiltonian that involves mean field corrections. So that way we kind of link the optimizations of the separate circuits. So once the parameters of the small circuits converge, we can put them all together to obtain a near optimal solution that can be used to initialize the full parameterized quantum circuit. Okay. So You might be able to imagine how this could work for a really simple like brick work circuit like the last one I showed, but often people want much more complicated circuits for their interesting VQE applications. But it turns out you can still use this approach by just including a shallow brickwork circuit ahead of something that's more complicated with, like more entangling gates, all-to-all entangling gates, right? So in this case, we would only pre-train the brickwork layers, and then after we pre-train, we have something that brings us in the vicinity of the ground state, and then we can just use the rest of the circuit to take us the rest of the way. Okay, so I'll talk through a little bit of pseudocode just to break this down. After we've kind of selected what our small circuits look like where we draw our lines, then we can start by just randomly initializing all of these small parameterized quantum circuits. We'll also initialize our mean field measurement values just to be zero. And then in a loop for each fragmented circuit, the first step is to reinitialize any overlapping parameters. So that those are the parameters that belong to gates that are appear in more than one circuit. So we're going to reinitialize them with our neighboring circuit's values. That's just to help ensure that at the end of the optimization, all the different circuits agree on parameter values for those circuits. After that, we'll basically just update the circuit parameters like you would in VQE, but we're going to use the mean field modified loss. Again, that's to link the different optimizations. And then finally, after you have new parameters, you can update the mean field measurements of the circuit's system qubits. Okay, so once you do that for each fragment, one optimization iteration is complete, and you can just keep doing this in a loop until your parameters converge or until reaching, you know, some maximum number of iterations. So there's one last important ingredient that is going to boost our performance. So in addition to the fragmentation, we can also batch our pre-training. So that just kind of increases our chance of finding a really good initialization. So here's how this looks. We're just going to randomly partition our system qubits a number of times, say t times. And we can do this in a way such that we constrain the maximum fragment size and the maximum number of auxiliary qubits so that these small circuits remain classically tractable. So after we have those random partitions, we can train each set of partitioned circuits, minimizing that loss, like we just discussed. But crucially, we can use classical resources, and we can do this in parallel, because these batched optimizations, they don't really have anything to do with each other. After pre-training, we'll have t different optimal solutions that we can choose from. So this is the point where we would pull out our quantum computer, estimate the loss of each optimal set of parameters, and then we can just choose the one that produces the smallest loss as our initialization for the final optimization, which again will be completed using quantum and classical resources like people imagine VQE. Okay, so let's look at some results. I'm going to consider those all-to-all Ising-like models again, but this time we're going to set the transverse field to be zero so that it maps to max cut optimization graphs. Okay, so let me break this down. We're going all the way up to 15 qubits now using Penny Lane to do the simulations. So this panel plots the final percent error in the ground state energy after we've optimized the circuit. And the horizontal axis here is just kind of an index corresponding to which model we're looking at. So we did a total of 500 models. So in dark green, this is kind of what we're comparing against. This is the exact same circuit architecture, but we randomly initialize all the parameters at the beginning and train it as you would train. And then in light green, this is our approach, where we do the pre-training and then initialize the circuit and train it. So, and then finally, let's see, these dashed lines, these are the geometric mean of the 500 data points. We're doing geometric mean rather than arithmetic mean, just since, you know, the orders of magnitude different on the y-axis. Okay, So looking at these final errors, you can see that our method does really reduce the final error by orders of magnitude, and this gap actually grows when you look at larger systems. And let me just briefly provide some details, some hyperparameters, what we're using for this training. This is a batch size of 10, so we're basically trying 10 solutions and then picking the best one at the initialization, not at the end, but. The maximum number of qubits per fragment is 3, and we have 2 auxiliary qubits in each fragment. So that means we're simulating at most 5 qubits to get the pre-training done. Okay, so now this lower panel is the number of iterations required to reach convergence using the exact same stopping criteria. So not only does the fragment initialization give us a better solution, it actually does so in much fewer iterations, again, using the same stopping criteria. So we can zoom in just on one particular example here for n equals 15. You can see that the randomly initialized circuit kind of hits a wall during optimization. In fact, it just ran out of iterations. I set a max of 5,000. While on the other hand, the fragment initialized already begins at a much, much smaller percent error, and then it quickly drops another 3 orders of magnitude. Okay, so the last thing I want to show you guys is how this scheme depends on batch size. So in this plot, I'm plotting the fraction of cases. Let's see, yeah, the fraction of cases where our fragment initialized final error is larger than the randomly initialized. So this is kind of counts the number of failures on a case-by-case basis. It measures like how many times it didn't help us. So you can see that if we only try one, or we only pre-train one set of small circuits, then this is pretty significant, and it grows with system size as well. But just trying a handful more, really modest numbers, batch sizes, we can really reduce this drastically. And then on average, so this is again the geometric mean, again, we see that same trend where more batches reduces that average error. But you'll notice that I also plotted the random case. And you see that even if we only try one fragment into solution, there's a really good chance on average that we'll do orders of magnitude better. So a potentially interesting future direction, I think, would be in understanding whether there's a more deterministic way of selecting the fragmentation, like where we draw the lines ahead of time, like just looking at the problem Hamiltonian and drawing those lines, rather than relying on the batch method. But right now it's kind of unclear if you can do that efficiently. So yeah, that kind of brings me to the end of my talk. So hopefully I've convinced you that it is possible to approximately link separate quantum simulators with limited communication channels. We saw that you can steadily increase your performance by including mean field corrections and a progressive number of auxiliary qubits. If you allow even limited quantum information transfer, then you can boost the performance even more. And then lastly, another important takeaway is that this fragmented framework can also be used to pre-train a parameterized quantum circuit using a piecewise approach that can be implemented using only classical resources, which provides better solutions in less time, which actually translates to many fewer measurements required and less time in the lab. So with that, I want to thank you guys for your attention. And yeah, just any questions?
Hi. First off, this is a really interesting talk, and I'm really excited about your results. I wanted to ask whether you had thought about why it is the case that your randomly initialized versions did so much worse. Sorry, I don't know about the feedback. But And I was wondering whether you had thought about whether barren plateaus are playing a role, because I know that randomly initializing anonsots is one of the criteria necessary for deep circuits to lead to barren plateaus, which drastically impacts the training time.
Yeah, yeah. I definitely think that's most likely what's happening, especially when you see that, you know, the average error just goes up and up as you increase the system size. I think it's exactly a barren plateau issue. And basically with the initialization, we're just starting somewhere close to, you know, where the, I can't think of words, the global loss minimum, right, is. So,
yeah. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
I think my question's a little related.
Okay.
So it's clear from your results that your method does a lot better in the simulation loss. And then my original question was, do you have an intuition on what is providing that huge improvement? And then you partially answered it in showing the dependence on the number of batches. So then my real question is, do you have any results that show which part of your method is more important once you kind of account for the number of batches and the improvement that you get from that? Does that make sense?
Yeah, like maybe the size of the circuits you consider versus, say, including the mean field corrections.
Right.
That's a good question. I haven't broken it down like I did for the time simulation results, but that's something worth considering, I would say. Yeah, I did actually. I tried it without mean field at first, and it seemed to still do pretty well. But I think the mean field just reduced basically that starting error, like where you start. Yeah.
So I got two questions. So the first one is relating to your fragment VQE. So it seems to me that you are optimizing the parameters independently in both the different fragments and the different batches. Have you looked at sharing the weights between the optimizations? So for example, you have T batches, all the parameters are the same, your partitions are the only different thing, and you have the loss function comprising of all the batches. Have you thought of that?
That's interesting. So maybe two things. So the circuits in the same partition, they do share parameter values for their overlapping gates.
Okay.
But it's true that from what I tried, the different batches do not. So that's interesting. So just trying the same parameters, just changing the partitions.
Yeah,
I didn't try that.
Okay.
But
I see. Another question is with regards to the application before this.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems to me that you mentioned that you are teleporting a different qubit for the quantum channel at you change it for the time steps. My question is doesn't that consume entanglement resources? And if you're assuming you only have two ancillas, are you assuming that you're replenishing entanglement after every time step?
Yeah. So I would say that this is one of the details that I didn't get in the weeds on myself. But I think generally, yes, if you were using some kind of teleportation protocol, you would have to generate more entanglement, which, again, that's one of the reasons why these operations are so costly. And then in terms of, did you ask about measurement resources as well?
No, just entanglement resource.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'd like to ask you about the relation between what you're doing on classical simulations. In which sense is the first part of your talk is essentially an approximation scheme that has little to do with quantum computing, and that's what we have been trying to do for quite a while. So did you try to see if it's a good approximation scheme, you know, on its own without any reference to quantum computing? Whether you can actually control the error, does it scale? And also, maybe for the second part of your talk, it's the same thing, really, because all this VQE is something that we can do on classical computers. So the hope of VQEing being of help is that we actually need some part of the Hilbert space that we cannot really reach classically. Mm-hmm. And so the question on most of all of these simulations are done in regimes where anyway the ansatz are overexpressive, which means that we are still in a regime where we have more parameters than the size of the Hilbert space, which is kind of the trivial regimes. So did you look at how it scales, whether it works classically? And maybe this is a good technique for, you know, classical computers before, you know, anyway, we won't have this for a while, so what do you think?
Yeah, so let me see if I understood all the questions. So for the first scheme, I agree. Like, it's definitely approximate. And I think our focus was, can we get the state of the qubits local to a fragment as close to correct as possible, rather than maybe like a full picture? So that's why I focused on things like, you know, single qubit expectation values even. And then the second question, you were asking about like the scalability of the VQE application.
In general. Whether all this scale, because
yeah.
For, you know, of course, if you take a few qubits, you put more information, things will improve.
Sure.
But the question is, how does that sound when yeah. you go to larger systems?
Yeah. So, for example, in these results, I'm actually using the same like sized circuits even as we scale the system. So I think that's important, and that's kind of what we were thinking, so that we could target even larger systems. We're just simulating one extra circuit to go another 3 qubits, for example. Does that kind of make sense? Yeah, so obviously like 15, we can still simulate this classically, that's why we have the results. But the idea would be that we would go to circuit sizes much, much larger and just pre-train little circuits of say size 5, piecing them together. Yeah, okay.
I have a question about the Hamiltonian choice and how the mean field corrections are working. I wonder if the particular choice of Hamiltonian, that is, you know, large number of connectivity Ising model, is friendly towards mean field. Maybe you didn't even have to do little pieces and connect it. Maybe you could have just done mean field altogether. It would have, like, have you studied how, you know, the size of your regions affect the results? Mm-hmm. And so maybe more generally, I mean, this is a really interesting focus study of a particular type of model. And until you carry out similar study for other type of model, you will never know
yeah.
in principle, right? But if you have any sense of, you know, whether the success really took a lot of juice out of model that is generally mean field friendly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we did actually also consider a Heisenberg model. And I think one of the things that really dictates the performance is just the number of interactions.
Right.
So
the number of interactions, the friendlier towards mean field it is, right?
Sorry, I missed the beginning.
The farther range the interaction is,
yeah.
Mean field will do better.
Sure,
because it increases the dimensionality.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess I think still in terms of like the error metric that we derived, the variance. So for example, if you look at a Heisenberg Hamiltonian, then that variance is going to have 9 terms instead of 1 term because it gets squared, basically. And so basically for models like that, you do see that the time simulations degrade much faster. And I think it just really has to do with that. Mean field, I mean, it provides some corrections. I'm not sure how far you could take it. I don't know.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You have another question? Yeah.
Could you go back to maybe some of the results in the first part where you had the curves that trended downwards in time?
Yeah. Were you interested in the quantum or the classical?
I think it was specifically
in. See. Yeah. There we go. There.
Or actually, no, it was in the classical.
Okay. This one.
Mm-hmm. Okay, wait, no, it was there was one where the lines cross each other.
Oh, yeah, I think that was the auxiliary, like comparing which auxiliary you encode.
Right, so this is showing which choice is best in your encoding, or which auxiliary qubit you
choose. Right, how your auxiliary choice determines performance.
Right, so do you have an intuition on why these lines are crossing at certain times?
Yeah, so first of all, I'll say that the only things crossing really are mean field versus no mean field, so that's the dashed versus no dashed. In terms of auxiliary choice alone, like if you compare no mean field versus mean field, those lines do not cross. So that's one important, I think, distinction. Right, so like I think if you only looked at, say, the solid green and the dashed green, I don't expect them to cross until maybe all information is scrambled or incorrect. Does that kind of make sense?
Okay, one more.
The phone. One last question was about like the details of your implementation. Did you do these simulations on just like a virtual backend with no noise, or was there a noise model? Was there a device involved?
So yeah, no noise. And we're doing, for the time simulation, we did like exact time simulation, exponentiate a Hamiltonian kind of thing. I guess the only source of error is the size DT that you choose. And we used PennyLane to do all those simulations. But that's really what limited us, so we only could go to 12 qubits for time simulation.
Okay. I got a second piece, which it's maybe just like a comment about like when you're randomly initialized, because what you had a plot where the randomly initialized version just kind of hit a wall.
Yeah.
One thought was barren plateaus, which we talked about, but another one which you might distinguish between is whether... whether the randomly initialized version is getting stuck in a local minima. It occurs to me that your method might be actually kind of good for avoiding those local minima if it starts you off much closer to the global minimum once the pre-training is done.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely a possibility. Yeah. We didn't, like, look for specific signatures for the random results, but...
Your fragments are space-like, except for the brick wall. Can you also do space-time, like when you have the circuit? Can you do more non-trivial time-like cuts to define a fragment?
Interesting. So I think maybe one of the only issues, possibly, is, say, your initialization, right? Mm-hmm. So, like if you were to change the fragmentation, then you might not have like a pure state that you could initialize that fragment with, and you might run into some difficulties.
Exactly. Yeah, makes sense. Oh, maybe I should check online. Sorry, I can't see the Zoom. So if anyone online would like to ask a question, speak now or forever hold your peace. Going once? If not, that's end of this session. We have a break until 3:15, okay? And then we'll have two back-to-back talks. So let's thank our speaker again and see everyone at 3:15. Yes.